Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 298. I'm Patrick Gray. And we've got a great show for you this week. We'll be chatting with the convicted spy, prison escapee and bank robber, Christopher Boyce, who is also known as The Falcon. And we're chatting to him about the changing face of espionage, as well as WikiLeaks, Manning, Snowden, and the radically changed world that awaited him when he walked out of prison in 2002.
I think that the surveillance state will get stronger and stronger. I'm not optimistic at all.
This week's show is brought to you by Context Information Security. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Context consultant Paul Stone about some research he presented at Black Hat USA in Vegas back in July. His talk picked up a lot of buzz, and in it he shows how you can do a pixel-by-pixel screen scrape with HTML5-based timing attacks.
It's very similar to the CSS history sniffing that was quite a lot of buzz about a few years ago.
It's a cracker interview, so big thanks to ContextIS for sponsoring this week's show. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we begin this week's news with the fabulous story that the GCHQ owned the ever-loving shit out of a Belgian telco.
Yeah, it was some more Snowden docs. He really is the gift that keeps on giving. There was some documentation which was the GCHQ kind of crowing about a successful operation in which they penetrated the Belgian telco, Belgicom. It looks like they, watering hole some of the network engineers, owned their desktops, and then went onwards from there into the guts of the telco. What's interesting is that the stated goal of this exercise was to compromise the GRX routing infrastructure. So GRX is the inter-telco roaming network. So that they could intercept mobile data roaming for people presumably in Belgium, which of course is the seat of the European Parliament and NATO and a bunch of other interesting things like that. So yeah, they owned up the telco specifically to get those people who were roaming there. So interesting. Yeah,
I mean, who would be interested in owning the devices of people who travel to Belgium? I mean, yeah, turns out pretty interesting, a pretty target-rich environment. But yeah, I mean, the extent of the compromise is downright impressive.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing you would expect, Intel operations to do for this again, right, is to own up telcos. It makes sense. But given that the Belgians and the English are, meant to be pretty chummy, if I was the Belgians, I'd be pretty pissed. And if I was a telco security engineer, a risk guy, like, this is, something that you need to show to your to management people to really illustrate that this threat is very, very real.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. If you were working in a network security for a major telco, you'd really want to have a look at this case and sort of dissect it and maybe have a bit of a look through your own stuff and make sure that it hasn't also happened to you. The other thing that occurs to me is that it might actually make a bunch of people want to go and work for GCHQ, because it looks like that, if that's your day job, that's kind of fun, right?
Yeah, I'd do that for a living.
I'm sure you would. And that's not the only revelation, Snowden revelation reported on by Spiegel. Apparently the NSA is spying on international payments, which isn't really surprising news, I wouldn't have thought.
No, we've talked about them, tracking the money around the place, that being one of the key tools for a number of times in the past. But what's interesting here is, really seeing some data about the kind of the scale of that operation. Some of the leaked documents suggest that back in 2011, their TrackFin financial database contains something like 180 million transaction records, the majority of which, some 84%, is from credit card transactions. So they're busting into, and it's alleged to Visa's network here, helping themselves to credit card transaction data, as well as the SWIFT interbank transfer network. And being able to follow credit card transactions, globally, to figure out where money is going to and from, is a very, very powerful tool. You can absolutely see why they would do it. But Visa have come out saying that, they care very much about security and that they're not aware of anyone having owned them. Well, that's not what the slide deck says.
That's true. And funnily enough, the division within NSA is called Follow the Money, which is a supreme irony considering that phrase was first coined in relation to Watergate. That's what Deep Throat told Bob Woodward, man. Follow the money. And now you've got the NSA naming. Yeah, you see what happened there? But funnily enough, I mean, you know, it is interesting that they're owning up these guys and, you know, looking at these transactions. But the SWIFT stuff, I mean, that was big news when that happened after 9/11. All of a sudden, I think it was the CIA and the NSA just started yanking transactions. Like, you know, if a known bad group was sending money that touched SWIFT, man, they'd just basically black hole the cash, right? So it didn't take them long to figure out that they couldn't use traditional banking anymore. So I think that stuff's been quite effective.
Well, yeah, of course, the question is now whether they have to stop using credit cards. So, you know, good luck with them. Maybe it's Bitcoin all the way.
Now, in other news, I mean, this got a mention at the end of last week's show, but we haven't had a chance to discuss it yet. RSA has told its developer customers to stop using a random number generator, which is thought to have been subverted by the NSA.
Yeah, so this is the dual elliptic curve random number generator that I think we've talked about it briefly, but yeah, the one that is alleged to have an NSA backdoor has been weakened in such a way that would benefit the NSA. It was the default RNG in one of the RSA crypto toolkits, the BSafe crypto toolkit, and RSA came out with a statement basically saying that everyone should, you know, all of their customers who use this set of crypto tools should move to a separate RNG, and the toolkit does have a number of random number generators available. But for RSA to come out and say this is a pretty big deal, and it's certainly drawn more attention to this than perhaps you know, some of the other coverage prior to the statement had.
Well, I mean, if you do a bit of quick Googling, you'll see that Bruce Schneier wrote a story about this for Wired in 2007 saying, did the NSA put a backdoor in this particular algo, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, yes. So I'm wondering why it took 6 years for RSA to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be using this as our default RNG, you know what I mean? But that's why it's a sign of the times when you've got RSA publicly saying, get away from it, back away, you know? But the warnings were there.
Well, yeah, we saw there's an article actually running on Wired at the moment, written by Kim Zetter, which talks about a presentation given at a crypto conference in 2007 by a couple of Microsoft cryptographers, Niels Ferguson and Dan Schumo, where they talked about this exact algorithm, and they speculated about the fact that there was this, you know, rather strange property of the algorithm, which could quite conceivably be a backdoor. And this was a lightning talk and was obviously, you know, designed to, you know, be a bit edgy. To get some, you know, attention amongst all the other lightning talks. But it does, you know, make some quite realistic suggestions about the fact that this, you know, could plausibly be a backdoor. Of course, then, in contrast, John Callis said, right, this is too obvious to be a backdoor. You know, Bruce Schneier basically said, like, if this is the best that the NSA can do, then we've got other problems as well. So there's a little bit of argument amongst the cryptographic community as to, you know, exactly whether or not it is a backdoor. But certainly the fact that we saw this, you know, discussed as far back as 2007 is quite interesting. And, you know, there's not very many places in the crypto world where there can be this much confusion. And, you know, maybe the fact that we can't tell what's going on is not really a good sign for this algorithm in general.
Well, I think that one is going to drop to the bottom of the list of the RNGs that are most likely to be used. Just a feeling there.
Yeah.
Now, there's a new bill being floated in Congress by a handful of congressmen that would limit the NSA's powers. I mean, we've seen similar little things sort of bubbling up in Congress, but I personally doubt that this is it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like this is going to be the comprehensive one or the one that really does make it all the way through, though it is good to see that this is getting continued attention and they're attempting to address, you know, some of the issues with, you know, with the way the NSA plays fast and loose with their targeting rules, you know, looking at ways to stop some of the reverse targeting where they look for foreign communications to an American so that they can spy on that American and other, you know, sneaky things like that. But yeah, I think you're right.
It's genius.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this isn't going to be the one that makes it all the way through, but we do have to keep, you know, they have to keep pushing and eventually, hopefully, they will, they'll come up with something which will actually stick.
Now, over on your shores, Kim.com is suing the New Zealand government, specifically suing the GCSB and I think the police as well, over their electronic snooping on him, which was, you know, found to be illegal, and there's been all sorts of fallout because of that. But nothing will make people reform more than having to pay a guy like Kim Schmitz, you know, what is it, $4.8 million, I think he's after.
Yeah, so yeah, he's been cleared to go ahead and sue the government. Obviously, our government attempted to prevent him from filing a lawsuit in the first place. But yep, he's allowed to go ahead. And yeah, 4.8 million New Zealand dollars, which is about $12 in anyone else's currency. But yeah, he will. It'll be interesting to see how this unfolds because the he has the option there to really kind of drag things out into the open through the legal process, which it could be fun or awful depending on what your perspective is.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards fun, actually.
me too, obviously, but all of the spook apologists around here will probably be grinding their teeth.
Not referring to anyone specific, I'm
no,
sure.
No one in particular.
No one in particular, like a colleague or... No, anyway.
Like a colleague or, yeah.
Now, rounding out our coverage of Snowdengate this week, Dropbox is... joining a list of companies that want to publish more information about the number of NSA requests that they have received. You can tell your users how many thousand requests you received, but if you got 200, that doesn't really help you, which I guess is what Dropbox is kind of hinting at here. But they're off to court. Everyone's off to court. Dropbox is added to the list.
Yeah, well, hopefully this does make it through. I mean, the real benefit here, of course, is for the smaller companies. You know, people like Dropbox, who have a lot more users, are going to have reasonably high numbers. But yeah, it's when you're in the 1 to 1,000 category that this is really going to help.
Now, also potentially off to court is Google, because apparently, and I love this, given all of the shit we're dealing with from the NSA, this is what we're worried about.
I know.
Google's Gmail keyword scanning might violate wiretap law, judge finds. According to the headline in this story, running on Wired.
Yeah, this is I Google reads your mail, right? And they read your mail to A, give you advertising, and B, to filter your spam and do the inbox categorization. And apparently this is wiretapping, according to the California District Court, this is weird, isn't it? It really is.
It's just really strange. I mean, imagine, the government taking action on Google about this. It's like, can you just get your own house in order first?
Well, exactly right. And the funny thing is, right, the service provider like this, in theory, are... it's not wiretapping when it's your service provider doing it as an integral part of the service. And, of course, like, you don't pay for your Gmail, right? It's paid for by advertising. So, of course, selling you contextually relevant advertising is an integral part of the service. The whole thing is ridiculous. But, yeah, as you say, the fact that the U.S. government would prosecute Google for this... when they're in the middle of indeed spying on everybody everywhere for everything, it's just ridiculous.
I wonder if we could convince the NSA to give Americans a tax break if they consented to surveillance. That might be the similar principle,
That's a great idea. You got upper management written all over you, buddy.
Gotta love an Office Space quote wherever possible. Now, the data brokers in the, some large data brokers in the United States, it looks like they've been owned sideways by ID theft services. This is a big story that comes to us via Brian Krebs, a fantastic bit of journalism here.
Yeah, it really is. The he's tracked down one of the couple of services that do, for example, name and date of birth and social security number lookups. You can pay to look up people's details and things. And a couple of those services appear to be sourcing their data from inside some of the really big U.S. aggregators. There's evidence in some of the data dumps that Krebs obtained that the source of this data is inside people like LexisNexis, which, of course, is a very, very big data aggregator, and some of the other U.S. aggregators, which, for them, this is absolutely hitting them right in their core business, the sensitivity and the privacy of the data that they hold.
And we're even talking about companies like Dun & Bradstreet. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, really. I mean, it is a big deal. It makes sense, right, that if you were in the market for, selling this kind of data to the underground, that, owning it is much cheaper than acquiring it through any other more legitimate means. An organization like... Dun & Bradstreet, I mean, they're complex organizations. They're just as targetable as anybody else. But yeah, this is really not a good look for any of the big data broker companies. But they've got to be scrabbling for damage control for this, I imagine.
Now, there's a fun piece up on ThreatPost about some new techniques for doing hardware backdoors that are basically undetectable. It's a nice little read, this one.
This is just super sneaky. These researchers came up with a way where... and I don't understand all of the hardware details because it gets pretty crazy, but essentially they can alter the polarity of the doping agent on the silicon wafers during manufacture to alter the properties. And they have this damn proof of concept demonstration where they can essentially dial in how many bits of randomness are in the random number generator on Intel Ivy Bridge CPU to either strengthen or weaken the quality of the RNG and then have it still pass all its self tests and do so in such a way that it's basically impossible to detect with any of the current kind of chip verification technologies, which is a pretty powerful demonstration, and I'm sure there's plenty of people who are looking at that and going, yeah, we should do that. We should phone the guys over in our department that does this already and say, did you know about this? But yeah, it's very, very sneaky stuff, and if you're into hardware backdooring, this is definitely something that you should read.
Look, I think as much as, you know, I mean, when sort of APT became a mainstream issue and we started seeing sophisticated malware, a lot of people were shocked by that. Some others had expected it to emerge. I think in 5 years from now, we're going to see a lot of very sophisticated hardware-based stuff being discovered in the wild, but it's my guess that it's already out there now. Do you know what I mean? When you look at the types of skills that the spook community and the associated outsourcers are looking for at the moment, a lot of it has to do with hardware. So, expect news in that space. And in somewhat related news, I guess, Darren Pawley has a great little story up on SC Magazine Australia looking at how to detect malware hiding in peripherals. I thought this one would be interesting to you, Adam, because you've done work on exploiting systems through DMA. This research is really looking at finding malware that's trying to use DMA tricks to own you.
Yeah, it is very, very interesting research. I mean, we've seen, DMA-based malware and DMA-based attacks, stuff that I did with FireWire, stuff that Snare's been doing with Thunderbolt, other things, people running malware on the GPU that can use DMA back into the main system. And it's a very interesting line of research. I mean, this guy has come up with, or is demoing, essentially it's kind of like a way of doing antivirus detection or doing cross-view detection on DMA bus transfers. So he sits there, he snoops the bus and attempts to correlate bus activity with what the CPU actually asked for, and then from that detects sort of anomalies on the bus, which is more power to him for actually doing it, because that's some pretty hard going stuff. But yeah, it will at least give us some tools to spot this kind of thing that doesn't require hardware modifications and doesn't require anything particularly exotic. So yeah, very interesting work.
Now, the beast attacks against SSL were very interesting. It was long thought that they had been mitigated. Apparently, maybe not.
Yeah, there's been some complexities, I guess, with dealing with Beast, where, the main mitigation option that you could implement on the server side was to move to RC4, but RC4 has its own set of issues, and it was kind of a trade-off for a lot of people as to whether or not they did that. And, the easiest option was, of course, to wait for the browser vendors and all the SSL client library vendors to work around the Beast attack in the client, and we've seen that done in some of the tools. The major browsers, notably with the exception of Apple, have implemented client-side mitigation for Beast. But it was always a bit of a trade-off, between what your mitigation options were and, what impact that had on the RC4 issue. So yeah, it's been a complicated story. We've had a few customers actually call us on our advice recently, when they've misconfigured their SSL.
It's funny how everyone gives a shit about crypto now, huh?
all of a sudden, yeah. But no, the fundamental here is, of course, that Beast is basically a man-in-the-middle attack, and the RC4 one is basically a passive attack. And, looking at the way the threat model and the environment has changed in the last 3 months with Snowden, you have to prioritize passive attacks over active ones at this point, I think. But either way, yeah, it makes our lives difficult, both as security consultants and as people who actually have to, configure and run the stuff.
Well, I think everyone's freaking out a little bit over TLS and SSL, so we're going to see some innovation in that space over the next year, I would guess. Just quickly, the Pirate Bay co-founder, Gottfried Fartholmwag, who was actually originally sentenced to 2 years in prison by a Swedish court for his role in a bunch of attacks against a bank and Logica, the IT company. He's actually had his sentence cut in half down to a year because it turns out that it couldn't be proven that he hacked the bank because he was saying, hey, someone just used my computer remotely. It's what I call the my dog ate it defense for computer hacking.
Yeah, he has. He's managed to weasel pretty good. I don't know the specifics of the weaseling, but yeah, he's been arguing that somebody else might have proxied or hacked his machine, or it was a virus, which, maybe it was. It's plausible. But yeah, either way, he's got 1 year less in the Swedish pound me in the ass equivalent.
So he's going to be out in half the time. I'm sure he's very happy to hear about that. Now, not surprisingly, a bunch of German hackers have discovered how to bypass the fingerprint reader on an Apple iPhone you know, 5S. I mean, that is the least surprising news of the week, but they've shown how you can do it just with a bit of printer paper, right, and some glue, you know. So it's really not difficult to replicate someone's fingerprint. And I think you were saying the other day that, you know, it's really nice of Apple to go out there and spend all the money deploying biometrics so that the rest of the world can realize that it doesn't work.
Yeah, thanks, Apple. It was really, really swell of you. Because, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, biometrics by and large have been fairly broken for a while, and fingerprint auth especially so. And it's nice to see the CCC guys, you know, demo this. There's a quite a good video if you want to show some of your colleagues of them, you know, taking a high res photo of someone's fingerprint off a glass, printing it out. And then, you know, building a little mold out of, you know, of latex rubber and glue and stuff, and then using that to bypass the auth. Exactly what you would expect an attack like that to be. And yeah, Apple, what'd you think was going to happen?
Well, it's a shitload easier than trying to brute force the actual unlock code. So yeah, way to go for security, Apple. That's great. Yeah. Oh, now Google is actually making some changes to Chrome. They're going to kick out a whole bunch of plugins starting next year.
Yeah, well, they've been talking about this for a while, which is they're going to boot out the support for the classic NP API, which is the plugin API that was introduced by Mozilla way back, you know, 15, 20 years ago now, that things like Flash and Java use to provide browser plugins. So they're going to deprecate that plugin interface and stop everyone using plugins other than or through their old interface. They have a new replacement API. But in general, they're trying to encourage everyone to go HTML5 or use their native client capability, but you know, that's a little bit problematic. But it's going to kill, you know, some of the more obscure plugins for a lot of people. But I mean, I guess if you run Chrome, you're probably running, you know, fairly new shiny stuff anyway. But you know, overall, I think a good move. You know, I wouldn't like Firefox to throw it out as well, because I need to have a browser somewhere that supports this for testing stuff. But my main browser, yeah, I don't really want it.
Yeah, you don't really need Silverlight, right? So
they're giving nobody needs Silverlight.
They're giving Silverlight the ass. Oh, now here's a nice one. There's an iMessage app for Android, so that, you know, people on Android can iMessage their buddies. Yeah, it turns out that app doesn't really look very trustworthy when you look at it in a little bit of detail.
yeah. So the this iMessage app, it doesn't really talk native iMessage from your phone to Apple like you might naively expect. Instead, what it does is it sends your message and all of your, you know, all the account details that you're going to use to interact with the iMessage world off to a box in China, which then appears to proxy your message back into the Apple network through a hacked up Mac Mini, which, or maybe a pool of Mac Minis if the load is particularly high. No one's very clear exactly how this works or exactly what's going on, but either way, it can't be good. The service in the middle, you know, can at the very minimum read all your messages and perhaps steal some of your creds, and at worst, you know, jack your accounts. So yeah, not a good look.
Well, it also has the ability to silently download and install random APKs to your device, which is another nifty little feature.
there is that as well, yeah. It doesn't look super reputable, no.
Oh, now, we spoke some time ago about the whole issue of Yahoo recycling these user IDs. And, you know, there was some concern at the time when they first floated this that people could get, you know, account resets and, you know, reset other people's accounts because they've, you know, it's like an orphaned email or whatever. So, you know, I sign up and grab a handle that you used to have, and then all of a sudden I can reset your Facebook or your Twitter or whatever. Yahoo said, no, it's not going to be a problem. We've found a way around it. Yeah, it turns out it was a problem.
Yeah, well, I am just so f***ing shocked right there. But yeah, so apparently people have indeed been getting emails from Facebook and whatever else, know all about the people whose accounts they now have. And I'm, you know, what else was going to happen other than this, Yahoo? Really? What did you think?
Look, at the end of the day, though, I still feel it's probably the responsibility of the account holder who's left that thing, you know, go off and to not have personal stuff still going into a dead mailbox. But, you know.
Sure, I agree. It's just Yahoo came out and said, oh, we've taken care of it, it'll be fine. And clearly this is what was going to happen.
No, you haven't. Now, look, that big click fraud botnet that was, you know, using Tor for CNC is still around, still growing, still bubbling around on the Tor network. The only reason that I really brought this one out to discuss this week is because I think it's pretty good advice these days, now that malware writers are starting to use Tor for CNC, that you should really be blocking entry nodes from your gateway. And if you see a packet destined for a Tor entry node, it should probably set off a few alarm bells.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the use of Tor for this kind of malicious stuff is not super new, but it does seem to be gaining in popularity. And the fact that, you know, people are running large-scale click-forward botnets through it is certainly interesting. But yeah, you know, Tor entering and exiting your network probably is something that, you know, should be unusual. And, you know, it's not super difficult to detect. So yeah, if you are in the operations, security operations center of, you know, of a serious business sort of place, then this would be, you know, a good use for a couple of hours of your time.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree with that. Also, Microsoft, there's an O-Day floating around in IE8 and IE9, which has apparently popped up in Japan. This story actually calls it a watering hole attack, which is kind of funny considering it's a mainstream media site that's serving up the exploits. That's not a watering hole, that is a reservoir, everyone. Yeah. So, that's kind of a big deal, which is a pain in the ass. No word yet on when a patch is coming.
Yeah, Microsoft have released some advice, but the actual core bug hasn't yet been fixed. Apparently, this is implicated with the Deputy Dog campaign that I think it was FireEye that we're talking about just recently. But yeah, primarily targeting people in Japan, as you say, very large-scale watering hole attack using some pretty sweet browser O-Day to drop Trojans and go onwards from there. Well, serious business stuff.
It's rare to see an O-Day in something like IE8 and IE9 being deployed so widely. I mean, you just don't really see that often these days, do you?
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty, it is an interesting campaign. It'll stand out a little bit for that reason. And actually, there's some suggestion in the FireEye research that it's the same people who hit Bit9. You may recall those were the application whitelisting vendor, an AV and application whitelisting security vendor that got hit maybe a year ago now. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's the same crew. Cough China, Cough Nation State. You know, clearly they have some business transact in Japan that needs that kind of serious business.
Yes, very, very serious business. Lots of shells, lots of connect backs going on. I'm guessing they're having a hard time sifting through it all. So more cola for you guys. Now in a bit of news, it isn't really news, I guess. There's an industrial control systems vendor that has just fixed some hard-coded credential bugs about 2 years after an advisory into them, which is just, you know, sign of the times. They still suck. Apparently, the iOS 7 upgrade fixed 80 security bugs, which is kind of cool. I'm wondering, though, does that mean that Apple are fixing the same bugs in iOS 6 for people who don't want to upgrade, or probably not?
I'm not clear exactly what the support lifecycle is for iOS 6 now that 7 is out. Either way, you probably want to upgrade for other reasons because it's, you know, it's pretty and stuff, which is the most important thing.
It looks like it was thrown together by George Clinton's hairstylist, my friend.
It is a little bit bright, yes. But anyway, in case you needed a reason to justify to your friends why you're running a operating system that does indeed look like a Crayola set, you could say it's for security reasons, it's best practice. DSD Top 35 said I should patch my things. And so I did.
Now, Apple has also updated Apple TV to 6.0 and fixed 50 plus bugs. Thanks, Apple.
Yeah, apparently they also shipped an update which bricked a bunch of people's Apple TV boxes. They've now fixed that. So yeah, you should go upgrade your Apple TV. But it's an interesting kind of little backwater operating system, I suppose, on the Apple TV. But just don't read PDFs from your TV. Probably is the core advice here.
Yes, I think that would be sensible advice. Now, there's some more problems with Ruby on Rails, which is, you know, I mean, Ruby on Rails is one of those things that every time someone shakes it, they tend to see some pretty scary stuff falling out. You know, there was a big round, I think, what was that, like earlier this year or last year, when there was just like a whole suite of really serious problems. It's been another issue found with Ruby on Rails, which could expose session cookies in Ruby on Rails apps, which is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, Ruby does this. There's a little bit of crazy going on in the Ruby on Rails world, and sometimes that crazy does, you know, have weird side effects. And we saw that with the mass assignment bugs that you referred to a while ago, and the YAML parsing bugs. But yeah, this one is interesting because the core of the issue here is that it defaulted to client-side session storage, where all of the contents of the session is actually stored out in a cookie that's encrypted and given to the client rather than server-side. And it basically means that the server abdicates control of the lifetime of cookies, and that, you know, in some environments that really doesn't matter, and some web applications that really is quite important. And this is not the sort of thing that you should just kind of, you know, pick because the framework decided for you. It's not the kind of world-ending bug that's going to get GitHub owned like, you know, some of the earlier Rails bugs. But if you are a Rails dev, really kind of think about what your options are, whether you're going for server or client-side cookie storage. because it is important to the security architecture of your app.
Yeah, I just wouldn't feel, I mean, forgive me if I'm wrong, right? But I wouldn't feel particularly confident deploying Ruby on Rails apps for anything serious. I just don't think it's had the scrutiny yet.
No, there is a little too much weird and crazy in there. Although, I mean, though that said, right, we're about to talk about some bugs and struts, and you know, that's had a much worse record and is significantly more mature in enterprise.
Yes. So, well, speaking of which, yeah, Apache have actually upgraded struts to fix a horror show.
Yeah, yeah, there are yet more struts bugs, and them, and as I was, I guess, as I just said, right, struts is all over the place, and there's quite a lot of you know, embedded applications or management applications that use struts that are never going to get patched. So keeping a handle on those in your organization is pretty important. So yeah, more struts bugs. They're not quite as bad as some of the previous ones, yeah, like if you've got struts apps, it would pay for you to go and read this and understand what it means in your environment.
Now, the constant stream of late of Cisco bugs is continuing with around 8 vulnerabilities patched in iOS.
Yeah, there's been quite a few of these over the last few months, and some of them have been real, you know, real humdingers. This month's bag is a little less crazy. There's a couple that are particularly interesting. One in the network time protocol, NTP, which is something that gets into all sorts of places in the environment, and another one in IPv6 fragmentation, which, I mean, let's face it, we really shouldn't be talking about fragmentation bugs in Cisco products in the year 2013 AD. Like, they should have that under control. There's a couple of other bugs which are DOS-related, which, you know, in some environments could be quite a big deal. But yeah, you have to patch your routers too, and yeah, some of these are not good.
No, indeed. So go forth, sort it out, but get ready for the next one because they are flowing pretty freely at the moment. It turns out there's a bit of a glitch in the Facebook Android client. It actually wound up sending photos in the clear. Now, I've seen mobile apps do this. I remember being at a con, I think it was KiwiCon actually, a couple of years ago, and I had an iPad, right? And I'm like, do I really want to get on Facebook? So I had my buddy just, you know, sniff everything, right? So I could see if it was what it was throwing around in clear text. I mean, the whole thing was encrypted, except photos were not encrypted. So it seems to be like the way that you used to develop apps to make use of SSL. You'd gradually sort of migrate the whole thing over. But yeah, it turns out someone screwed up and Facebook was still sending clear text photos. Oops.
Yeah, which is clearly not a good thing when you want to, you know, upload your selfies in private from the cafe, or, you know, pictures of your butt or whatever it is you guys stick on Facebook. But yeah, someone reported this and actually managed to score something like $2,000 for reporting this, which, you know, clearly you should have done this when you were at KiwiCon a couple of years back. would have you know, paid for your booze. But no, it's apparently they're going to fix it. But yeah, don't upload pictures of your butt to Facebook in the first place, let alone in the clear. Would be,
yeah, I don't really see that it's a big, you know, it's not a big scary deal. I guess, though, if people are sending private messages and attaching photos to them, you know, it could be a little bit like, yeah, you might throw up some interesting stuff that way. But I'm guessing that's fixed now. But Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Not a problem, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
Insomnia Security's Adam Bialow there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's feature interview now, which is part one of my interview with convicted spy Christopher Boyce. I first tried to interview Chris back in 2005 when I was researching a story about the Pine Gap spy base here in the Australian desert. Back in the early 70s, a young Christopher Boyce picked up a job working for the defence and intelligence contractor TRW. He worked on a program that Pine Gap was a part of, and through his work there, he claims to have discovered the US government was undermining Australia's democratically elected left-wing government. There's a lot of other evidence from that time to support the general thrust of what he was saying, too. More on that next week. But he was disgusted, so he set about wreaking havoc on the US intelligence community by passing off classified documents and ciphers to the KGB in Mexico through his friend Andrew Dalton Lee. Now, they were both caught in 1975, but in 1980, Boyce escaped from Lompoc, robbing 17 banks before he was recaptured around 18 months later. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. He was eventually released in 2002 and moved to live the quiet life in the Pacific Northwest with his wife, Kate. Now, back in 2005, I had Kevin Mitnick track Christopher Boyce down using public data sources. Kevin is very good at stuff like that. Now, unfortunately, Chris didn't want to be interviewed back then, but now he has a book out. It's a sequel to the two previous books written about him and Lee, The Falcon and the Snowman and The Flight of the Falcon. It's called The Falcon and the Snowman, American Sons, and it's a really good read if you've read the other books. So, long story short, I finally got my interview, and I'm glad it took me 8 years to make this happen, because in the last 8 years, WikiLeaks was born, Manning was arrested, and Snowden started leaking NSA documents. Now, as you'll hear, there's actually some fairly substantial common ground between Boyce, Manning, and Snowden. So I got Chris Boyce on the line and started off by asking him what he thinks of Edward Snowden.
Well, I think that he's done a service to the Bill of Rights. I think he's protecting our freedoms. I'm glad that he did what he did. I think it's too bad that he ended up in the Soviet Union. I think he should have gone where he was going to release that information and stayed there. I don't know where that, Venezuela or somewhere else, but not to go on an around-the-world jaunt chase. That distracted from his message. So I regret the fact that he went to Putin's Russia. Mm. He should have gone to Venezuela or somewhere else. But I'm glad that he did what he did. And I'm glad that Manning released what he released. And I hope that there are other contractors out there contemplating some similar move. But the problem is, from my view, my experience of being slammed down into solitary confinement, like they've done to Manning, is that I think that the federal government is trying to terrorize contractors. I think they're trying to put fear in their hearts to some of the conditions and the, what they kept Manning for 100 days naked in an isolation cell. Even the trial judge said, well, we can't do this. This is unconstitutional. But what they're trying to do is scare the living crap out of contractors, that we will destroy your life. We will take your brain apart, neural passage by neural passage. But I think that if contractors are going to leak information, they need to go where they are going to have asylum, stay there, and then leak. And then that way the story becomes what they're leaking, not the chase. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's been a lot of reporting about Snowden where, the more relevant thing to be talking about might be what he's leaking. I think that's actually changed. The more recent revelations about the NSA's covert program to sort of undermine public cryptography standards has really, Snowden's got a bottomless briefcase. Every time the NSA, I was at a conference in Vegas in July when General Keith Alexander was there and did a big speech about how harmless and wonderful the NSA were. And then Snowden just kept releasing documents that proved a lot of sort of misdirection in what Alexander was saying. So, I mean,
I think you have a good point, and the chase is over. It appears that he's going to stay where he's going to stay. And I'm sure that the Guardian and other persons have copies of everything that he's got. But it does seem like every time the government opens their mouth, he just releases more.
Oh, it's amazing.
Compromising information that makes them look like fools.
Chris, if you were 30 years younger, do you think you would have been more like an Edward Snowden than someone who was going to sell stuff to the Russians?
I think the big difference between, for me to answer that question, is that I have a quarter century of experience in the federal prisons. I almost spent 10 years in solitary confinement. And I just don't think I could ever do that to myself again. I couldn't bring the rage of the government down on my head again. I don't know. Snowden's a braver man than I would be now after having. I couldn't do that again. And I'm sure that there are hundreds and hundreds of other NSA contractors who also are thinking, I just couldn't bring the power of the federal government down on me like that. And he's a better man than I am at this stage of my life. I suppose I'm a little bit worn out from it all. It's not easy to come out of all those years in prison, but there's a big difference now. It's so much easier to release stuff, as you were speaking. Back then, if you went to a New York Times reporter, how would you know? You just wouldn't go to the FBI.
So you think that that's a real concern, is that the media is, I don't know, I think the media feels the pressure a little bit from the establishment, right?
Oh, most definitely. Mm.
So do you think that that means that there's a role for organizations like WikiLeaks?
I think that eventually the United States government will get their hands on him too. I don't think he's going to be elected to the Australian Senate. I think they'll eventually get it. But yeah, I wish there were another 100 outfits like WikiLeaks. And I'm sure there are many people that want to repeat, you know, WikiLeaks.
What, their MO?
Yeah. But the problem, as I see it, is that I had always thought that the Internet was going to be this thing that opened up the world. That, I mean, I came out of prison and I went, wow, look at this. This was going to be what united people everywhere, which created a free flow of information. But instead, it seems to me that it's become something for the government to monitor and watch us, to collect all our emails and monitor all of our, you know, who we're calling and how long we're speaking to them. I'm kind of shocked by that, by Snowden's revelation. I thought that the Internet was going to be something that broke down secrecy, but it appears to me that the NSA and the British are using it for evil purposes, are destroying our civil liberties in the process.
Well, it seems like they've definitely gone a step too far. I think we're at the point now where, you know, most people agree with that. And, you know, you've got this absurd situation where FISA, you know, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, is even, you know, spanking the NSA for violating its orders and sort of the scope of its warrants. And because it's a secret court, nothing really happened to the NSA. So where do you think we go from here with all of it? What would you like to see happen, I guess, is what I'm saying. I mean, you know, this is a, you know, you were one of the first people to take a, you know, what you say was a moral stance against the overreach of government just sort of generally when it comes to, you know, intelligence matters. What would you like to see happen? At what point is it, would you be satisfied that things are on track, you know, and right?
Well, I think that I'd like to have a real review, and I, and then specifically, why should the government record all of our emails? And why do they need to keep a record of everyone that we call and how long we speak to them? Things like this are abuses, I think. I mean, they need to go. Will they go? I doubt it. Or, you know, in this country, all of our addresses and return addresses and all our packages and letters are photographed now by the post office. Why is that necessary? That just seems to me like overkill. I think everything since 9/11 has been the Patriot Act and all this. It's all overkill. It's overreach by the surveillance state.
It seems that, you know, WikiLeaks Assange, you know, Assange thought that if he published a whole bunch of information and sort of enlightened the public with these revelations, that things would change. Nothing really has changed since the WikiLeaks dumps. We've got Edward Snowden also, who's releasing all of these secrets. Things might change, but nothing has yet. So to what degree do you think, you know, the problem is that the public doesn't have access to enough information about what governments are doing versus the problem being just general apathy? What do you think's going on here?
Well, I agree with what my wife Kate said here not too long ago, that you know, the average American is more interested in how much, you know, if he has enough cream and sugar in his coffee than his civil liberties. I have to tell you, Patrick, that I'm very pessimistic about. I think that the surveillance state will get stronger and stronger. I'm not optimistic at all that civil liberties are going to be protected, and I think that that's the direction that we're headed. I think that we will become, like President Carter said the other day, that we're not America's no longer a democracy. I agree with him. I can't really tell you that I'm optimistic that things are going to get better. I think that things are not going to get better. But, you know, and it's legitimate to protect us from foreign terrorists. All right, but why do you have to record everyone's email? It seems to me that the surveillance state spends most of its time spying on the American people themselves. The American people have become, it seems to me, the enemy of the intelligence community bureaucrats more than foreigners.
Well, I don't know if you caught the news, but it turns out that the NSA has been providing tips to the DEA. So, and instructing DEA agents to concoct alternative sources of the information. So really you've got a government intelligence agency giving tips to other agencies and then instructing them to lie to the courts about the source of their information. I mean, that's, to me, that was probably the second most staggering revelation. The first being the telephone call, you know, duration, origin, destination data that you're speaking about. I mean, are you familiar with that news about the DEA?
No, that's the first I've heard of that. What shocked me was the fact that the NSA is forcing the communications and internet companies and the security companies to leave these back doors into their security systems, so that really we really don't have any privacy whatsoever. The good thing you can say about Snowden, though, is that now this has all come to light and people are talking about it. Will anything be done? I don't know. Will Congress do anything about it? I doubt it. Mm. But at least there's a discussion, and at least this allows Google and the other internet companies to push back, to fight this intrusion. Mm. Into the internet, you know, but you can tell just from talking to me, Patrick, I'm not a technical person. I'm 60 years old, you know, and I lost 25 years of my life.
Well, and those
while
25
all this developed.
Yeah, exactly, so right? Exactly. So those 25 years is when all of this happened, right? But I mean, as much as you say you're technically illiterate, I mean, information is information, whether it's written on a piece of paper or stored in ones and zeros, right? So all that I see that's changed is that we've taken information and made it infinitely and instantly replicable, which is why we've wound up with things like WikiLeaks,
right.
Which is why we've wound up with these, you know, people just taking huge caches of documents out of places. You know, the idea of using a camera to smuggle out a few documents these days is just completely foreign, right?
Yeah, I mean, I used to smuggle out secret documents hidden in potted plants. Mm. I mean, if Snowden had to do that, he would have been at it for a million years, especially Manning. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, too. I mean, we've got some leakers like Chelsea Manning. We've got leakers like Edward Snowden, who it seems that all, you know, if I put you guys in the same category, it's there's three of you who had ideological motivations to actually take classified information and push it out into the public domain, except in your case, you took this information and gave it to the Russians. But really, I'm wondering how it is that you can morally justify the decision to actually hand over those things to an enemy of the U.S. at that time.
Well, I actually myself did not sell them. My co-defendant did. And I had never really intended that is how it should play out. But to be honest with you, Patrick, I think that mainly I was just so fed up with the American intelligence community that I wanted to damage them. And I just went off on a one-man war against the intelligence community. As ridiculous as that sounds, that's basically what I was doing.
Now that's really interesting that you say that, because when I look at someone like Edward Snowden, when I look at someone like Bradley Manning, I actually wonder how much they are in a separate category, which is that they want to reveal information publicly that you know, that they feel it should be in the public domain. But you know, when I look at a guy like Bradley, or a girl these days called Chelsea Manning, and I look at what she did and how she arrived at that decision, it really seemed like she was very angry at the system as well. So to what degree do you think your motivations and the motivations of someone like Chelsea Manning are actually the same? Because it seems strikingly similar.
Well, you know, I grew up in a very conservative household. You know, my father was an FBI agent. I was steeped in history. I went to parochial schools. I had an utterly conservative upbringing. But as I grew up, I watched the Vietnam War unfolding. I watched the assassinations. I watched all of the racial riots. I watched the impeachment of President Nixon. And it just seemed to me that step by step by step, the federal government was becoming worse and worse. And I had really no experience growing up as a young man in the national government becoming anything but more and more, in my eyes, evil, to the point where I just utterly rejected the whole thing. And if I could, you know, I wrote in another article before that I was tilting at windmills, probably also. I was looking for a big enemy to fight. I don't know what's in my personality that caused me to want to do that, but I wanted big, powerful enemy to joust.
Do you perhaps see that there's a bit of common ground there with Manning?
I would think so. I think that, but I also think that Manning was utterly repulsed by all of the content of much of what he was revealing. I just, honestly, Patrick, I just feel sorry for the guy. I feel sorry for Snowden because I eventually think they'll get their hands on him. And I think that the Department of Justice is going to turn their lives into living nightmares.
So you think Snowden will be more likely to be bussed around into all of these different, you know, places and tried and sort of put through the federal system? You're not expecting a bunch of guys with black helicopters to come and shoot him?
I don't think that he'll stay in Russia forever, and I think that eventually he will move on, and I think that eventually they'll get him. They'll never stop trying to get their hands on him, and when they do, they'll make an example out of him. But it's my fervent hope that among those hundred thousands of contractors that there are others like him who have the same views and who are just as appalled as he is, and who are willing to put their lives on the line to protect civil liberties. And if we have any hope, that's where it lies.
That concludes part one of my interview with Christopher Boyce. Part two is coming up next week and is more focused on the US government's alleged betrayal of the Australian intelligence community in the Whitlam years. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Paul Stone of Context Information Security. Paul is a senior consultant with Context IS in London, and he did some fascinating work that he presented at Black Hat USA back in July. Here he is explaining the work.
Okay, so my talk was called Timing Attacks, or Pixel Perfect Timing Attacks with HTML5. And I was looking at web browsers and how JavaScript and a web page could do a timing attack to get at sensitive data belonging to you, essentially. So I looked at two things. One was browser history. So whether you visited certain links or not. So, you know, with the timing attacks, I could tell if you've visited Google or if you visited LinkedIn or a whole bunch of sites.
Let me just interrupt you there. But were you enumerating unknown URLs, or could you just confirm someone had been to a known URL?
Yeah, it was a known URL. So you have, it's very similar to the CSS history sniffing that was kind of... There was quite a lot of buzz about a few years ago, and it's now been fixed by web browsers. So this attack essentially, you know, it used to be possible in every web browser. You could use JavaScript and CSS to tell what color links were on a web page. This has now been fixed in all web browsers. And in 2010, Mozilla came up with a fix for this, and all the browsers have implemented. So in theory, it should no longer have been possible. But essentially, I found a way to use a timing attack to do the same thing, to tell what color the links are on a web page. So it's basically, you'd have a list of 100 or 1,000 websites, URLs, and I'll be able to go through those and tell yes, no for each one, whether you've been to that site before.
But you won't be able to just pull some unknown URL out of that person's history?
No, unfortunately not. That's something I'm looking at. So maybe
yeah,
next
that's,
year.
That's next year, right? Yeah. Yeah. And then the second part was the ultra cool party trick, which was which is where you got the pixel title, which you were running a timing attack to do a pixel by pixel screen cap, weren't you?
That's right. Yeah. So essentially the way that worked was with iframe. So if you could, if I can frame a website, so load a website that you're logged into inside an iframe. And lots of sites do block this now because of clickjacking, but there's still a whole bunch of sites that still allow framing. So if I can load your website into onto my malicious page inside an iframe, then again, I could use the timing attack and SVG filters to read the iframe one pixel at a time and build up a picture of what's inside that on what's on their web page.
Now, what I love about this attack, Paul, is that it's the probably the least efficient way of skinning a cat, but it's also simultaneously awesome. So, what? I'm guessing that if you can iframe someone, you're probably already in a position to do a whole bunch easier things than actually use a timing attack to scrape their screen. But I still think, as I say, it's completely wicked. But I got to ask, how long does it take, and how much? What sort of resources does it require? For both the attacker and the endpoint, because I would have thought that if you're trying to do a screen scrape on a timing-based attack, pixel by pixel, that's going to be an awful lot of bandwidth and an awful lot of CPU for the client, right?
Well, in terms of bandwidth, there's no real bandwidth involved. It takes place completely on the browser side, essentially.
So you just throw a bunch of JavaScript at it and wait for it to pop out an answer.
That's right. So in my demo that I did at Black Hat, I loaded the Google Plus chat widget, and that's you'll see that on most Blogspot blogs. So that widget's interesting because it essentially is loaded in an iframe. By default, they have to allow framing. And what I did there was it actually has your name on it. So I read not the whole page, but just the bit that has your name on it. So I read that it's about, I don't know, 100 pixels by, say, 16 pixels high. So it's just a very small area. And that takes about 30 seconds, probably.
Would the user notice? I mean, is their CPU going to ramp up to, like, you know, six times capacity?
Yeah, it depends how quickly you want to do it, right? So in my demo, I did it. It's pretty fairly CPU intensive, right? And also, being a timing attack, it's fairly sensitive to whatever else is going on the computer. So it's the kind of attack that would work best if the computer were idle, if the user had perhaps gone away for their lunch break and left a web page open, and that would be the best time to do this when there was nothing else going on.
So is there any way that you could actually structure the attack so that it would kick in when idle, or it's really impossible to tell, isn't it?
Well, the interesting thing about the way the attack works is it does essentially work by the common thing between the reading the history and reading the pixels. Is this new browser feature called Request Animation Frame. And this is something that the browser makers added to allow smooth animations to take place. So if people have used JavaScript before, they might have heard of something called Set Interval, which lets you run your JavaScript, say, at a fixed interval, say every 100 milliseconds or every 50 milliseconds. Request Animation Frame is a bit like that, but it's tied to the frame rate or the refresh rate of your screen. So the idea is that you can schedule your animation to run at, say, 60 frames per second. But what the attack takes advantage of is that if the animation can't quite keep up with the 60 frames per second, if there's very complex graphics or if there's the JavaScript taking a long time, then that frame rate will slow down. So essentially what Request Animation Frame lets you do is to measure the frame rate of the browser. So to measure the time between each frame, and that's what I'm doing. So doing something fairly complex, doing some complex graphics that depends on the color of the link or the color of the pixel.
Yeah, so it depends on the previous state as to how long it actually takes to complete it, right?
That's right.
How are you actually getting the feedback there on whether or not things are speeding up or slowing down?
It's essentially this callback. So we know if I'm running at 60 frames per second, I know everything's going very quickly. And then once I start doing, trying to read the pixels, I kind of set things up so that, say, a black pixel will take 100 milliseconds to draw between frames, and a white pixel will be, well, as low as possible, but something like 50 milliseconds. So that's essentially how the attack works is, I read one pixel, and if it's 100 milliseconds between frames, then I know it's a black pixel.
And what sort of practical applications can you think of from an attacker's point of view for this? I mean, I like the idea of being able to enumerate, just a visitor to your website. You can, you can just pull their names. That's kind of nice. I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of marketing professionals listening to this right now getting very, very excited. Because I don't know that it would it be illegal? Kind of. But anyway, what else can you think of for a good application for this from the attacker's point of view?
Well, the final demo that I did in my talk was I went beyond just building up the picture because I thought that was quite cool. It's quite a kind of movie style attack doing it one pixel at a time. But I thought I could speed things up a bit. So what I did was go from just building up a picture of text to kind of reading the text OCR style. So the way I did that was to build up a model of the particular font. So if you know the size of the fonts and the font face that's on a web page, I wrote some JavaScript that would essentially analyze the characters, so it knew where each pixel was, and then it would build up a binary tree of the font. So for each character, it would kind of read one pixel, and then if it was black or white, it would know, okay, it's either this bunch of characters or this bunch of characters, and then it would read another pixel. And by just reading a few pixels, you could tell which character it was. So instead of just reading, say, 100 or so pixels to get one character, you could just read, say, four. So the final demo was, instead of reading the my name off this Google Plus widget, was to load the source code of that web page into an iframe. And that's something you can actually do in Firefox. It's a little quirk of Firefox that if you, instead of loading the URL of a web page into an iframe, if you put a view-source in front of it, or load the source code, like if you right-click and do view source. And there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff in the source code of that web page and lots of web pages. There's things like cross-site request forgery tokens, authentication tokens, and in the case of the Google Plus widget, actually your entire Google Plus profile is in the source code there. So even like the private stuff that you've not made visible to anyone else, so stuff like your email addresses and your telephone numbers, that's all in there. So for my final demo, I did that. I loaded the source code of the page into an iframe and then used this OCR attack to read a bunch of telephone numbers and my Google Plus ID from there. And
that's invisible to the user too, because it's a hidden iframe, right?
That's right, yeah. So and that's pretty quick. So again, in about under 30 seconds, instead of just reading a few characters, I could read 100 or so characters or more very quickly.
Define very quickly.
So let's see. I read the Google Plus ID, which is about 20 digits, and then three telephone numbers, which is probably about another 20, 25 digits. And that was about 20 seconds, I think. So pretty quick.
So tell me again how you would actually exploit this as an attacker. Do you need to get you need the user to be loading content from your link or hitting a site that you own that iframes the stuff that they're trying to get to, right? So
that's right.
Yeah, you might want to register Facebook dot, you know, CZ or whatever and get them to click on that, and you can pop Facebook up in iframed, and then you can start doing funny business.
That's right. I mean, an interesting thing is a few years ago with the CSS history sniffing. So someone in 2010 did a study of they looked at the top 50,000 websites to see if any sites were actually doing this for real. And they found about 100 or so sites were actually doing this history sniffing and seeing what sites their visitors had been to and sending this back home. And there was a couple of ad networks actually doing this as well. So,
well, mate, 2013, the people we're really worried about, it's not the Russians, it's the marketers and the bloody NSA.
Well, exactly, yeah. So it's the kind of thing that, an ad iframe could do this, potentially on any website.
Right.
So
look, I imagine the interim advice is for the operators of websites, where possible, to be able to, flag for this not to be able to happen, for their content to not be able to be loaded in iframes. But is there anything the browser manufacturers can do to sort this out?
Yeah, so I reported this to Mozilla about a year ago, the pixel reading attack. And the way it worked was using SVG filters. So SVG filters let you apply fancy effects to SVG drawings, but you can also apply it to any part of a web page. So the thing that I was taking advantage of there was that some filters take a different amount of time depending on what you apply them to. So what Mozilla had to do was basically go through all their SVG filters and take out the optimizations in them, which made them quicker in some cases. So they essentially had to slow down a part of their web browser to fix this attack.
It's your fault. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's my fault if Firefox is a bit slower on some web pages. Sorry.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Guy. All right. That's actually all we're going to have time for. Paul Stone, thank you very much for joining the program to discuss your Black Hat talk, which, believe me, picked up quite a bit of buzz when I was on the ground there in Las Vegas. Thanks again, mate.
Okay. Cheers. Bye.
Paul Stone of Context.is there with a chat about his really, really cool research. Now, don't forget, Context.is has a presence in Germany, England, and Australia. Check them out for your consulting requirements and be sure to mention to them how much you appreciate their sponsorship of this podcast. But that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by David Bowie, and it's called This Is Not America. And it's in this week's show because it was written for the soundtrack to The Falcon and the Snowman, the movie about Christopher Boyce and Andrew Dalton Lee. Snowman melting from the inside, Falcon spirals to the ground. It's not my favourite Bowie song, but hey, it's not often we get a guest on this program who David Bowie sang about. And you know what? The lyrics are probably as relevant to the events of 2013 as they are to the events that they were written about in the mid-70s. And this version was performed live in England in 2000. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
For the very excellent film Falcon and Snowman. Came out sometime way back then.